Hi, it's Jeff Sachs here. As you can see, we have a promotional message reminding you that Purim is coming up, and this year, if you order your Mishloach Manot for delivery here in the State of Israel, from wherever you are, as long as they're delivered here in the State of Israel through Gilly's Goodies at the link posted now to the chat, Web Yeshiva will receive some support for those good works. So you get to send nice, tasty Humantashen or whatever else that they're selling, and Web Yeshiva gets some support. Because as you know, since Corona, our shiur has been meeting here on Web Yeshiva, and of course, almost all of Web Yeshiva's offerings are presented to you for free, which is a wonderful service. But there are, in fact, expenses of running Web Yeshiva. So whatever you can do to help support the spread of Torah worldwide is greatly appreciated. So visit Gilly's Goodies and Web Yeshiva to send your Mishloach Manot today. I could have had a career as one of those announcers on television. You also get, what did they used to give away on the game shows? Turtle wax to wax your turtle. And a Lender's bagel and an Iconit toothbrush. We are in Masechet Ta'anit, Daf Kaf Beis Omud Aleph. We're still talking about this topic of people that are possessors of great merits, even though they appear to be, rather simple folk, and yet in their merit, great things happen. The Gemara tells this Agadah. And remember, we are in a section of the Talmud that is very Agadah heavy. The Gemara tells of Rabbi Broka Chozo'o. That was his name, Rabbi Broka Chozo'o. Hava Shachiach Beshuka DeBei Lefet. He used to frequent a certain marketplace in a city called Bei Lefet, in a certain Babylonian town called Bei Lefet, wherever that was. Have a shechiach Eliyahu Gabei, and he would very frequently encounter, well, as people tend to do when hanging out in the bay, in the Bei Lefet marketplace, he would very often encounter Eliyahu HaNavi, who makes his way around, certainly within the world of Haggadah. Omer Leh. Yes.
Eliyahu seems to be a little more busy than he should get himself a couple of assistants. It's like, in other words, he is so ubiquitous that I don't understand why the Jewish people have to sit here and start saying Eliyahu Hanavi, Vimhei Rabbi Yameinu.
He's always there anyway.
I mean, it sounds to me like he's around every street corner, and I don't see him doing too much to help us as a people, even if he seems to be, very available, like almost a car service for all these various characters who I don't know who they are either. That's another thing. Three-quarters of the people that he all seems to be helping are people who we barely know from
well,
from
maybe they were simple folk in their own day, and that gives us hope that he helps us simple folk today. But but when you say, I take exception, Yehudi, I take exception to your idea that Eliyahu is not helping us out. In other words, if all he had done, then clearly he has done more and will do yet more. If all he had done was to provide us with these agadot, dayenu,
Yeah, but that's just it. You take agadot to simply mean a story, a tale, or you take it to mean an imaginative work of fiction. Like when you do agnon, you understand that basically what you're reading is fiction. It might have real elements in it, but the real is not the essence of what you're reading here. It's the imaginative.
Well, isn't that how we've been reading these agadot as well?
No, I've got the feeling we're reading them as true stories.
No, I don't.
If you basically want to represent it the way you just said it, then I have no problem anymore.
Oh, so then I stipulate that I represent it in that manner. But if you let me get on past the first sentence, we'll have an opportunity to understand what's going on here. So Rabbi Broka Chozo asks Eliyahu Navi, Ika Bahai Shuka Bar Alma Dahai Daati. Is there here amongst the teeming masses in this marketplace a ben olam haba, someone who is worthy of inheriting the world to come. Omar le, lo. He said to him, no, there is none amongst us here in this marketplace that are b'nei olam haba. Adahachi v'hachi. But by and by, chazalahahu gavra, dahava sayem mesane uchame, velo rame chuta betchelata biglime. But along comes a guy who's wearing black shoes and does not have tchelet, is not wearing tzitzit on his arba kanfot. He's not meaning, what does it mean to be wearing black shoes? So Rashi here, where's Rashi? Misane uchmane, uchame, right? Minalayim shchorim. He was wearing black shoes. Shalo kiminhag ayehudim. At that time, at that place, there were distinct codes of dress. I'm not talking about, you know, like codes of dress like the Nazis forced Jews to wear yellow stars, let's say. But as a matter of minhag, the non-Jews, the Bavlim, dressed one way and the Jews dressed another way. And one of the distinctions was that Jews wore white shoes and the non-Jews wore black shoes. You know the well-known saying in the Gemara that afilu charde de mesanai, that the your shoelaces, right? That you have to have distinct shoe wear from the non-Jews. That may have been, you know, and that's, you know, we have this custom which may be Kabbalistically informed, that when we put our shoes on, you put your right shoe on first, and then you put your left shoe on, and then you tie the laces of your left shoe, and then you tie the laces of your right shoe, which, you know, always seemed to me rather arbitrary. But apparently that was the opposite custom of Jewish folk customs. And then I always thought this was like strange, like, you know, the truth is that's how I put my shoes on because that's what the Shulchan Aruch says to do. But like I'm unaware that there is, that I'm going counter to some prevailing custom. It always seemed to me that there is no such custom that we're countering. But nevertheless, a Jew who wants to accord himself with the Shulchan Aruch does what the Shulchan Aruch says. But then I met somebody, a Dafka of Italian heritage, who told me that he's always very careful to put his left shoe on first and then his right shoe. It was a kind of, he thought it was a kind of superstition, you know, that he learned from his Italian grandmother who came over from Sicily or wherever it was. So it struck me that Taka, there's still, just like we have traditions in our world, so there are still traditions alive elsewhere. So the idea that there was distinctive Jewish footwear gives rise to this idea that at a time when there is such distinctions in the non-Jewish world, so then it's important for Jews to maintain some kind of distinct symbol. But here, this fellow, he's wearing black shoes, and he's not wearing tzitzis, meaning he's dressed, pardon the expression, we'd say, he's dressed like a goy. He's dressed like a non-Jew.
So you're saying this story is prescriptive rather than descriptive?
No, I'm saying it's completely descriptive. But we have to, I'm explaining what the meaning of pointing to somebody in the shuk who's wearing black shoes and no tzitzis. Is saying he apparently is not dressing in the manner that would have marked him in his time and place as a Jew.
Yeah, but will you put black shoes on a level of tzitzis? Doesn't that strike you as being a little weird?
No, one is a matter of halacha, and one is a matter of Yehudi. One is a matter of halacha, and one is a matter of minhag. But they are both markers. They are both clothing markers of non-Jewish fashion, right? In other words, Eliyahu HaNavi points this guy and says, you see him, he's a ben olam haba. So Rav Broka says to himself, that guy, he looks like a non-Jew.
What I meant by prescriptive is the Gemara trying to tell us that beyond what the Torah tells us we should wear, we should proceed to do things like should choose our shoe colors on a basis of the difference between what's us and the guy I'm wearing. That would be prescriptive rather than...
Yeah, but the Gemara says that. The Gemara says that elsewhere, that the Jews should wear and tie their shoes in a distinctive manner.
Yehudi, I'm begging you,
please let me get through the story, and then I'm happy to listen to any of your observations, but I can't, we can't stop every half sentence.
Go ahead.
So he says, you see that guy who's wearing the black shoes and he's not wearing a tzitzit? Omer Lei, hi, bar al madatehu. He is a ben olam haba. He is a ben olam haba. Rahat batre. So a broker goes running after him. Omer lei, my uvdecha. What's your, like, what do you do for a living? Which is a kind of funny question. In other words, he's a ben olam haba. Even though he knows through his knowledge via Eliyahu Hanavi that he's a ben olam haba. Even though he doesn't look like the kind of person you would imagine is a great, righteous, holy person. So instead of asking him, like, in what merit are you a ben olam haba? Or what great acts of kindness, you know, do you do? He asks him, what do you do for a living? Like, what's your job? Omar le ziloidna, go away. He says, I can't talk to you now. Vital machar, and come back tomorrow. I can't talk to you right now. Le machar, Omar le, my ovadach, what's your profession? Omar le, zandukana ana. I am a, Rashi explains, zandukana is a jailer. He's a jail guard. V'asrana gavre lechud unushay lechud. And I'm careful to lock up the male prisoners and the female prisoners separately. Urmina puraya bein hane lahane. And I put my whatever it is, the mat that I sleep on, or my cot, or my bed, in between to separate the boys and the girls, the men and the women.
Well, if they're locked up, what's he so worried about?
What's that, Yehudi?
If they're locked up, what is he so worried about?
And it's apparently they're all in one common cell.
Okay. And it's a jail, not a prison. Okay, I got it. So even in New York City, they never would do that. Okay, I got it.
Well, this was Buffalo a long time ago. It's not Rikers Island of today. Benani Lahani. And why do I do that? Why am I there? Like I remember the camp counselors used to make sure there wasn't any mixing going on at night. Right? Why am I doing that? So that they, the prisoners, will not come to sin. They will not come to sexual improprieties. And more important, ki chazine bat Yisrael diyahove. And when I see a Jewish girl, apparently even Jewish girls sometimes got locked up in this jail. When I see a Jewish girl that the non-Jewish prisoners have put their eye on her, right? Allah einayhu, they put their eyes on her. Masarna nafsha umatzelna. I sacrifice myself in order to save her. Yom achada chavat nara mi'urasa legaban. One time there was a certain prisoner who was a nara mi'urasa, a Jewish girl who is betrothed to be married to someone, and whatever happened, she got into trouble and she was locked up in this jail. Di'av bo nochri menayhu, and the non-Jewish prisoners were putting the eye on her. Shkale durdaya dechamra. I took the dregs of the wine. You remember their wine was different than ours. It had the sediments and the all the solid parts that were down at the bottom, you know, which, and their wine was much stronger. And he says, I took the dregs of the wine, v'shadai lo b'shipula, and I threw it onto her dress, v'omre dashtanahi. She is menstruating. In other words, he takes the red wine and he spills it on her dress to make it appear like blood, and he tells the non-Jews that are starting up with her, oh, don't go near her, she's menstruant. In other words, even the Bavlim, even the Bavlim that presumably would have, forced themselves on this Jewish girl. No, these were not tzaddikim, but they still maintained some kind of taboo about sexual relations, either taboo or according to their own traditions, with menstruant women. There's an interesting book that came out two, three years ago by my friend Professor Shai Secunda, called The Talmud's Red Fence. If you're interested, I can send you the relevant sections that discuss this and related Gemaras. The Talmud's Red Fence, which is a comparative study of Hilchot Nida and menstruation and the place that it plays in Jewish culture with its what he calls Iranian, what we call Bavel, the Bavli milieu in which the Talmud Bavli was formed. Judaism was not the only culture that had certain notions about Tuma Vetahara related to menstruation. So this story...
What did you say his name was?
Secunda, Secunda, Shai Secunda. It's an academic book. I'm sure it costs $175,000 to buy it on Amazon. But it's called.
Does he reference at all like Levant? Because it's also similar where you have a Russia, but he's concerned about the thing. And it's also
the obvious. He does observe that the obvious biblical intertext here is the story of Rochel and Levan, who, while stealing the trafim, her father's idols, she makes an excuse that she can't get up from the camel because the derech nashim, the way of the women, is on her. He even points out that elsewhere, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Kaf Dalet, 24 Aleph, I think, makes a kind of folk etymology. In other words, in Middle Persian, in Middle Persian, I know all of this only because I looked at his book earlier today in preparation of our class. In Middle Persian, the word for menstruation is dashtana is an Aramicization of the Persian word for menstruant, right? In other words, Aramaic borrows it from Persian, Middle Persian, whatever the level of the language was at that point. In order, does anybody have Dave? You have the Steinsaltz there?
I probably could get this, but I saw it. I mean, it is Middle Persian.
Yeah, no, but David.
I don't have the Steinsaltz. I have just the online Steinsaltz. I don't have the.
I assume the. Hold on, let me.
I'll look. You don't have to. Well,
I have it here.
But I'm trying to say, I definitely did see it in preparation.
Right. So, in other words, the.
He always would spot Middle Persian words in the Bavli. In other words, they were exactly weird. Dashtana comes from the Middle Persian word dashtan with a what we would call an accent, a U in French on top of the S.
Okay. 22.
Dashtan. I'm checking now to see what Karin has to say. But Yaakov Emel was constantly pointing out.
Yeah, that dashtan.
Everybody knows that the Mishnah is influenced by Greek. Everybody knows that in Eretz Yisrael, Greek gets into Midrashim all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we lived in Bavel for hundreds of years and produced major works there, not just the Bavli, the stuff of the Gaonim. And yet people, when they're told that Persian words are going to show up here and there, act like, what are you talking about? You have to be out of your mind.
I don't know if that's true, and certainly I just demonstrated that I that I do not subscribe to that idea. But here, the Steinsaltz points out that Dashtana, he mila parsit dashtan, sheperushan nida dam nida. That the word means menstrual blood in Persian, and it passes into Aramaic through the Persian. Although it undergoes an Aramicization in the process. So the Gemara in Daf Kaf Dalet in Avodah Zarah gives a folk etymology for the word, saying that it is from Derech Nashim. You remember Rachel says to Lavan, Derech Nashim, the manner of women is upon me. So take Dashtana Derech Nashim is a folk etymology. The Gemara does not think that's the actual way of the word. It's the way, it's a kind of linguistic midrash onto the word.
According to the Koran Talmud, they have here Zanduka, that word for a prison guard, that's from the Middle Iranian Zendan, and the word Durdaya, that one where he was throwing the wine, that's from the Persian Durdi, meaning dreg.
Right.
So now, in less than 10 lines, you have three Persian words.
Right, so again, I don't know, Yehudi, I don't know why you maintain that people deny that there's an influence of Persian. Because here, right here, you can't, nobody that knows anything at all about Hebrew Aramaic could pretend that these are anything other than loan words from the Persian.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, but listen, you go on out wide with Torah.
Okay, well, anyway, we're not there, let's focus on where we are.
Okay.
So, anyway, Secunda observes all of these observations. This is obviously these agadot are playing off of, and there he mentions a few other parallel agadot in which a pretense of nidav menstruation is put on in order to rescue or save a woman from the sexual predations of no goodniks. And it seems to be also from, but in other words, the precedent of Rachel is also significant because presumably Rachel was also faking it. In other words, it was a white lie, or in this case, a red lie, in order to get out of the situation, although not sexual in nature with her father, but in order to protect herself, from having taken the trafim. The Gemara goes on. Omar le, my taima. So he says to him, okay, that's his great mess. Now I understand why this guy, who looks like a goy, has such merits that he's a ben olam habo. He saves these Jewish girls from being raped by Persian prisoners. I mean, it's like, you know, you remember the Midnight Express, the movie about the guy who gets locked up in the Turkish jail? I mean, I can understand why this is a great schut, why he would be in Olam Haba. So Rav Broka Chazoa says to him, "Beseder Omer like my timer late lecha chutei v'ramet mis ane uchame." So why do you put on tzitzis and why don't you put on Jewish looking shoes? Why are you going around dressed like a Persian? So Omer le. Ah, ayelna v'nafekna beinina chrim, ki hechi d'lo leidu d'yehudona. He says, I circulate, I go up and I go out amongst the non-Jews, so that in order they should not know that I am a Jew. Who is he? This is Eli Cohen. He is a spy. He is undercover. Ki havu gazre gzerata, when they make a gzera, when they make a decree that they're going to go out and they're going to make a pogrom, they're going to do something bad to the Jews, mod ana lehula rabbanon, I am able to go and inform the rabbis what's happening, uvo rachame umevatle gzerayhu, and the rabbis can pray and get rid of the evil decree. But in other words, presumably, if he's that clever, he understands that he goes and he tells the rabbis, not as spiritual leaders who can pray to get rid of the gzeirah, but as communal leaders who can exercise influence or warn people or do whatever is necessary on a practical plane in order to pay. That's what I said. In order to exert influence, pay bribes in order to try to avert the gzeira ra'a. But in other words, within the framing of the Agadah, they do that through prayer. Right? So there's prayer, but there's also everything that has to be done under the table. You know, this, by the way, if you look in, let's say, a very different kind of literary source, the Shivchei Abesht and other Hasidic wonder tales, where there's stories of the Baal Shem Tov going up to heaven in a vision in order to avert some evil decree, right? So there's some very interesting historical scholarship that's done, which shows that these were actual cases, and the Hasidim tell of the Baal Shem Tov's, you know, tales of wonder through prayer and other good efforts to save the Jews. But we know that there were other efforts at play in the more practical realm. So my taima ki amin aloch ana, so my ovdech. So he says to him, why, when I asked you what your job is, amartali zil ha'idna v'tala machar. So why, when I asked you the first time what your job is, why did you push me off? Why did you tell me, go away, come back tomorrow? So I must confess that the first time I learned this Gemara a long time ago, I thought I understood. You know how it is. You develop an idea before you get to the next line in the Gemara and realize there's a different idea. But I assumed, what would be, let's imagine for a second that you haven't yet learned the Gemara ahead. Let's imagine for a second you've come to Shi'ur unprepared and you don't know what the Gemara is about to say. Suspend your imagination. Why might he not have answered him the first day?
He didn't know who he was.
But he didn't know who he was the second day either. Or he knew, either way, either he didn't know him the first day, he didn't know him the second day, or he knew he was a rabbi, but he couldn't answer for some technical reason on the first day. So I assumed that the first day, Baruch HaChazo comes to him and says, you know, who are you? What's your great merit? And he couldn't tell him because where was this conversation taking place?
In the shuk.
In the shuk. He there's ears everywhere, right? I can't tell you because I'll blow my cover. If he's a spy, he has to be discreet about what he reveals about himself and where he reveals it. So I think that's a pretty good answer, but the Gemara doesn't give that answer. It gives a different answer. So Omar Lei, Bahahi Shata, Gazreg Zerata. At that moment, the moment that you caught me on the first day, I was in the middle of trying to get a decree against the Jews revoked. They had just issued a decree against the Jews. V'amina, b'resha ozil v'eshma lula rabbonon. I was on my way to go and inform the rabbis, l'boi rachem ala demilta, in order that they should go and cancel the evil decree. Okay, so that's the story of the jailer. Adahachi vahachi, and by and by, atu hanach trei achai, two brothers come along. Says that that's what the Masoras and Shasi says. There's two fellows come along. Omar lahu, Omar le, Eliyahu says to Rav Broka, Hanach nami bnei olam de'ati ninhu. These two guys, they're also bnei olam haba. Azala gabayhu. So Rav Broka goes up to these two fellows, these two brothers. Omar lahu, my uvdaichu, what's your job? Now again, it's interesting that that's the question. The idea that somehow you're, it's what you do, it's your occupation that grants you this merit of being a ben olam haba. When we know there's so many different ways to be given Olam Haba. Although we saw in the earlier cases, you remember the case of the farmer who lends out his shovel or his hoe or his rake or whatever, his instruments of digging to the Chevra Kadisha to bury the dead. And the woman who doesn't have a profession, but a woman's work is in the home, cooking and baking, and she lends out her hot oven to other people, maybe to the poor, in order to cook their food. So there also, it has something to do with their work life, their professional life. It might, even though, of course, there are many ways to gain Olam Haba. And for a lot of people, the path to Olam Haba is dafka, not through what you do for a living. I mean, you do whatever you do for a living, you earn your living honestly with integrity, and that's a great value in and of itself. But in addition to what you do professionally, you volunteer and you learn and you help and you do, and that's your sources of merit. But in all of these agadot, they're all tied somehow to one's profession. So first of all, it's a great endorsement. It goes back to the Gemara about, it's interesting, now that I think about it, I hadn't considered this before, but we should really consider this carefully. It goes back to the Ilfa Gemara. Remember, Ilfa, instead of spending his life in yeshiva, goes off into trade. And one of the messages of the Ilfa Gemara, you know, he goes up onto the boat and he demonstrates his vast knowledge and mastery of the Torah Shebaal Peh, is that going into a profession does not in and of itself mean that you're destined to a life as an Am Haaretz. Right? And not only that, but in other words, having invested in a professional life, in a life of commerce, his example of mastery of Torah is an example to us all. So all these Gemaras seem to have some common theme about, you know, an endorsement of being involved professionally in the big wide world, that it doesn't mean that one automatically divorces him or herself from a life of Torah or a life of merit and adding to the salvation of the Jewish people. I think that's a very interesting way to think about how all these Gemaras, all these Agadot connect. So these brothers, if we have time, I'll put an asterisk here. I'll come back to that idea momentarily. So Adahachi Vadahachi, these two brothers come along. So he says, Mayav Daichu, what do you do for a living? So Amrule Inshe Baduche Anan. We are, well, I guess we're like jesters. We are Badchanim. You know, in Yiddish, you have the idea of Badchonim. You know, the jokers, like at a wedding, the people that you would hire to the wedding to do shtick and to do, to entertain and to do other things, were called Badchanim. So we're entertainers. I don't know if they were clowns or if they were,
the word itself. Huh? You have any idea? Is the word an Aramaic word?
Bet dalet. I don't know what the origin is, but it certainly gets passed into Hebrew if it's not originally Hebrew. But a bedicha, and even in contemporary Hebrew, a bedicha is a joke, right? I mean, it's a word that appears all throughout Shas. I mean, the idea of a milta bedichuta, potchen bemilta bedichuta, right? The rhetorical advice that when you're giving a speech or a class, you should always open with a joke. You should spice up your sermon with a little humor. That's homiletics 101 as a rabbinical student. So he says, what do we do? He says, well, we're the Badchonim. We're the jokers, we're the jesters, we're the clowns. And so why do we get Olam Haba? You would think, just like the jail guard is not ipso facto somebody that gets right into Olam Haba. And the clowns, the jokers are not necessarily you would think the most righteous to begin with. We cheer up the people that are depressed. Omrule, in Shevaduchianu, Mivadchinan Atsive. We cheer up, we cheer up the people that are sad. Inami, but also, Kichazina be tre de it lehu tigra, Bahadayu, when we see two people that are having a fight, Tarchinan avdinan lehu shlama. We try to make peace between them. They are Talmidei shel Aharon. Oev shalom v'rodev shalom. But they try to bring peace into the world, maybe through good humor. I was, a couple of weeks ago, I had to go to the emergency room. My kid fell in school and broke his wrist. So, you know, you never want to go to the emergency room. Right? And I was a good kid. My parents never once, I never broke a bone. I never got stitches. I never had nothing. Right? My parents never, I spared my parents all of that. You know, I must say that my own kids, we've had a few trips to the emergency room over the years. But Baruch Hashem, that's part of being a parent. But it's a terrible thing. Like, you know, you're waiting in the, and on top of it with Corona and the masks and everything else. So we're there in the waiting room at Shari Tzedek waiting, you know, for an x-ray and the whole thing. And they have, you know, medical clowns now that hang around the hospital. So I was just in a miserable mood. It was like a night that I had planned, you know, I had like 1,000 things to do. And instead, you know, you're in the hospital with your kid. I mean, I'm not angry at him, but still, you know, it's like one of those things. You're on a schedule and the whole train comes off the tracks. And he wasn't in a good mood, obviously. He didn't, thankfully, it wasn't a bad break, but it's not pleasant. And these clowns come along, and I must tell you, neither of us were in the mood for these medical clowns. But after about 2 minutes, you know, they really cheered us up. These two batchonim, these two medical clowns, you know, while we were waiting, you know, with the balloons, with the balloon animals and all this other stuff, they really cheered us up. And afterwards I thought, you know, Taka, that's, you can understand why those guys get olam haba. They make people, to make people feel good and smile is a good thing. But tell me if I've recently told this story about Rabbi Lichtenstein and the car with the gardener. Did I tell that story recently? No? You know, I teach in so many different places, I don't remember where I tell which stories. Years and years ago, I was at a press conference. Rabbi Lichtenstein, Zichrono Levracha, late of Yeshivat Haratzion, used to, from time to time, do these, questions and answers. They used to call it a press conference for whatever reason. And someone asked him about, you know, considerations in choosing a career. And, what you should do, you know, how you should think about choosing a career. So, you know, I don't know what I was expecting. I was a kid then. I thought he would say, well, like, you know, you should be a rabbi or you should be a teacher. But instead, in his inimical way, he told the following story. You know, if you've ever been to Yeshivat Haratzion in Alon Shvut, which is very close to us here, they have this beautiful facility and these beautiful gardens and beautiful, you know, grounds and landscaping and things like that. And there was a legendary gardener, the man who, like, you know, the landscaper, whoever he was, who was in charge of he was the groundskeeper or something like that. I think his name was Moshe. And in those days, Rabbi Lichtenstein and this Moshe both lived in Yerushalayim, and they would drive out to Alon Shvut. So Rav Aaron is driving from Katamon, where he lived, to the yeshiva, and he sees at the Trempiada, where people wait to get a lift, he sees this Moshe, this gardener, and he hesitated about picking him up because apparently this fellow was known as a real yakker. He was a real schmoozer. And Rav Aaron knew if he picked him up, this Moshe would schmooze him up the whole ride. And he needed that time, the drive out in the morning. It was his quiet time where he was able to organize his thoughts and go over in his head the shiurim that he had to give that day and, you know, the other work he had to do as Rosh Yeshiva and all of those things. But then, of course, I mean, here's this fellow who works for him. He felt, Rav Aaron felt bad about, you know, he was going to leave somebody who works for him standing out, and let's tell the story better, standing out in the cold, in the rain. So obviously he stopped and picked him up. Moshe gets in the car, says, Boker Tov Harav. Harav Omer Boker Tov Moshe. And they continue on their way. This is on the, remember, the old road out, you know, the twisty, turny road out before the tunnels, through Beit Lechem, out to Gush Etzion. This Moshe fellow doesn't open his mouth the whole ride. When they pull up into the yeshiva, Moshe says to him, Slicha Kvod Harav, please don't think I was being rude by not talking to you. You know, on the ride out to work in the morning, I find that's my quiet time. I need that time in my head to go over what needs to be planted and what needs to be trimmed and where the work has to do and what the different people on my staff have to be told, etc. And I need that time to organize my thoughts and get myself. So if Aaron told this story in answer to the question of what job you should choose, and he said, whatever you do, whether you're a Rosh Yeshiva or you're a groundskeeper or what, it should be as important to you as my job is to me, as his job is to him. It should be something that occupies your mind and your heart and your thoughts, and which you take seriously and which you obviously work with integrity, etc. So I think that I think of that story in the context of these agadot, which I think we have now concluded, this chain of agadot about these people, these kinds of, they're not exactly, this is not the story of the Lamed Vav Tzadikim. The story of the Lamed Vav Tzadikim are, you know, the righteous who in whose merits the world is sustained, according to the tradition, both the Talmudic tradition and then later, in its later Gilgulim in the Hasidic literature. But according to one element of that tradition, the Lamed Vav Tzadikim, the 36th Tzadikim, are Tzadikim Nistarim. Their true identity and their true virtue and merit is hidden. And even according to one iteration of the folklore within the Hasidic tradition, if we blow their cover, they're out. They're done. They have to either they have to retire as a Lamed Vavnik or they die. This is an idea which Agnon plays with in different ways in his story. So that's not what we're talking about here. There's no element of being tzadikim nistarim, but these people that we've encountered are all, let's say, tzadikim pshutim, you know, simple, righteous, holy, pious people, in whose merits great things are done and accomplished. Okay, we will. Yes, now Yehudi.
I give you what I've done with the word.
Okay, so why don't you share it with all of us?
That's what I wanted to.
Yeah.
The word is used in the Targum. It's an Aramaic word.
Bishtana.
When they have a word in Hebrew in the Tanakh that seems to be needs extra help, like the word alatz, ayin, lamed, sadi. Okay, so you have two verses in Tehillim which uses Ya'altzu l'cha o'aveh shemecha esmecha ve'el tzaba. Both of these, they use the word badach to translate. Okay? Mm-hmm. It sounds like what they mean here is not what we take it to mean, a joke or some kind of a story that makes people laugh. It sounds like it's a type of happiness which is, better than ordinary happiness. So another place you have it is when Haman goes out of it, Sameach Batov Lev, they say Haman Bayomahu, Sameach Batov Lev, so they use the word, but Mimdach. Okay?
That's in the Targum.
This is Targum Shani, so I don't know, no, this isn't Targum Shani. This is Targum Rishon, I take that back. Targum Rishon on Esther. So basically, what I'm getting at is, they seem to use it for, in other words, while I think your emergency room explanation is excellent. In other words, what you're saying is people who are down and out, they make them happy. And that's harder to do than just stop to make people happy.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's not something like Menachem Lavin. You know?
No.
It's more like just to do something. In other words, you know, that, but at least you can see how the word was used. I'll send all this to you in email. I just wanted to start it now. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you can. I'll send you the entire thing, all put together in email form. Okay? You'll get it within the hour.
I'll stay up waiting for it.
Yishar kochacha.
Yeah. Badach. Yeah. In other words, I just grabbed the jastro because it was closest. He translates badach or badiach as to be cheerful, to cheer up, to make laugh. Yeah. Okay. Todah rabah, Laila tov.